Welcome to Tentpole Trauma, the podcast where we look at movies that came with hype and high hopes, but left with crushing disappointment, either critically, at the box office, or both. Freed from the weight of expectations, we seek to examine these underperformers under a new light, parsing through the good, the bad, and everything in between with the hopes of gaining a better understanding as to why they failed to find their audience. Warning, there will be spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie that we're discussing today, I suggest you stop the podcast and go watch it. Then when you come back and listen, you'll get more out of the discussion. On this episode, we discuss Dragon Slayer. Okay, I am Sebastian, and I'm here with Jennifer.
Hello.
Another Just the Two of Us podcast.
Just the two of us.
We're going to be talking some dragons this podcast, because I've got dragons on the mind.
You got dragon fever, Sebby.
I've got dragon fever, because House of the Dragon is sort of hitting its stride on television.
Mm-hmm.
We are enjoying that show a lot
so far.
And to celebrate dragons, we are going to discuss the 1981 film Dragon Slayer, which is, in my mind, a sort of seminal swords and sorcery film of that era. That era was a really good time for these types of movies. And I think it's appropriate that we're discussing it during this run of House of the Dragon, because George R.R. Martin himself was clearly influenced by this movie. We both noticed several character names that were similar. And I was reading in Wikipedia that he considers this dragon, which is named Vimerithrax or something
it's
like
that.
It's
quite a name.
Vimerithrax, I believe, is how you pronounce it. And he said, that's a great dragon name. But he really loves the dragon in this movie. He likes this movie a lot. And this definitely has an influence on Game of Thrones and the Song of Ice and Fire world. I think some of the dragons look a lot like this dragon. And I even think that the sort of look of this film kind of influences Game of Thrones in a lot of ways.
Definitely.
More so than a lot of sword and sorcery movies that came out around this time. I saw this movie in the theater. I was very excited to see it because the big hype for this movie was that they were going to show us the best dragon that had ever been put on film at that time. Mm-hmm. They got all of the hotshot guys from ILM who'd worked on the Star Wars movies, Dennis Muren and Phil Tippett and a bunch of other guys. So this was like, you know, the big special effects thing. These guys were going to make a really realistic dragon. And my, you know, 11-year-old brain was pretty blown by the movie at that time. I was, you know, impressed by the dragon and whatnot. But you have seen this movie as well. Is that not true?
Yes, but I did not see it in the theater. I saw it when it was on HBO quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I had not seen it since then. So I didn't remember a lot of it.
I have to say, I think the experience of seeing the movie definitely was benefited by the big screen mm-hmm. treatment. I remember seeing it again on television when it would be shown. And I was kind of like less sort of interested in it at that point. I was kind of like, oh, this is a little slow. And like the dragon doesn't really show up properly until the latter half of the movie. But when we rewatched it the other night, I was able to sort of reappreciate the big screen experience of it because we've got a big TV and a Dolby Atmos system. So I feel like that did replicate the theater experience somewhat. Now, do you remember liking it as a kid?
I don't remember having much of an opinion about it because there were several other sword and sorcery films that were out around the time. As you know, it's No Beastmaster. That's my favorite.
Yes.
So it's not Beastmaster level of enjoyment for me, but I did enjoy watching it last night. And I just remember this movie, Beastmaster. What was the one that we were talking about with Michelle Pfeiffer?
Lady Hawk.
Lady Hawk was another one that was on a lot all around this time.
A little movie called Conan the Barbarian yeah. and Excalibur.
Conan, yes. I don't remember seeing Excalibur until later.
Excalibur is R-rated and it's not something kids should be watching.
So. No, but I mean, it was the 80s and, you know, anything goes. What were we watching the other day that we were surprised was PG? Oh, it was Race with the Devil.
Right.
That had a PG rating.
Yeah.
It was a different time. So, yes, there's a chance. Had Excalibur showed up on TV, I could have seen it for sure, but I don't recall seeing that until I was older, and I appreciate Excalibur.
It's a weird movie. It's yeah, John Borman.
I know.
So I think if you saw it as a kid, you might not even want to watch it just because it's so strange. It's not super exciting all the way through, so you might have caught a little bit of it on TV and been like, what's this, and moved on.
That definitely could have happened. Back to Dragon Slayer. I don't have much of a memory as to, I don't think I disliked it. I just don't think it made much of an impression, except for when we were watching it, I commented to you about the shackles.
Yeah.
So the shackles that the maidens have their wrists on while waiting to get killed by the dragon.
Yes, the sacrificial maidens.
As soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, I remember this movie because those shackles looked so painful.
Yeah.
And I also thought the dragon looked pretty great.
It still holds up. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's clearly an effect of that time. And there's, you know, multiple things going on. The dragon is animatronic at some parts, and they actually built a big claw and a big head, and then when it's flying around, it's more of like a, you know, spaceshipy Star Warsy type effect. There's a lot of different things going on, but I think the cumulative effect of it is still pretty impressive for the time. I mean, you know, it's not like the dragons that we see on Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon or whatever with the fancy CG, but I do feel that it has influenced those dragons and the way that they're presented.
I agree.
Well, why don't we talk about the movie? Let's just get into it.
Let's get into it.
So this movie was a co-financed movie between Paramount Pictures and Walt Disney. Mm-hmm. It cost $18 million and it made $14 million.
And that's 1981, $18 million.
Yeah, that's more than Star Wars or Empire Strikes Back. So that kind of tells you like what kind of budget that is. And it didn't even break its budget.
It didn't get the return on investment that Star Wars or Empire Strikes Back did.
Hell no. So it was pretty much a bomb.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember it being a bomb because I enjoyed it so much. And I just felt like it was a success in terms of its special effects. And I remember the reviews were pretty kind for it. You know, people were impressed by it, generally speaking. So in my mind, it wasn't that catastrophic of a failure, but financially, it certainly was a huge bomb. I will say that the movie up front has one, what I would call a minor flaw. And the beginning of the movie, we are introduced to who our main characters are going to be. We get to meet this wizard played by Ralph Richardson, who's sort of ailing, and we get to meet his apprentice played by Ally McBeal's Peter McNichol.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this group of travelers that have come to this castle where they live. And one of the travelers' name is Valerian.
Mm-hmm.
And Valerian is a quote unquote boy who is pretty obviously played by a female actor, Caitlin Clark. You know, all of this is fine. You know, we're sort of meeting these characters, and then, you know, we find out that they've been followed by this villain, Tyrion,
mm-hmm.
another name you may recognize from Game of Thrones. And this is just sort of setting up our players and setting up, you know, the reason for the movie, which is that there's this dragon that's been menacing this faraway community, Ireland or something like that. And they've sent these people to try to get this wizard to come kill the dragon because he supposedly is powerful enough to do that. And all of this is fine. However, we're going to then like cut to this scene a little later on where we see a maiden being brought to this dragon's cave. And this is the scene that you were talking about with the shackles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's trying to break free of her shackles and the dragon comes out. We don't really see it. We're getting sort of like Jaws mm-hmm. treatment where we're seeing just flashes of it.
Very much like Jaws.
This should have been the first scene, don't you think?
Yeah.
That would have made way more sense.
Yes.
And you would have gotten, you know, at least a tease of the dragon right off the bat.
And the danger that's involved.
Right.
Like, we don't really know, like, how gnarly it is until then. Like, we're only hearing like word of mouth when this gang of travelers comes asking the wizard for help.
It's an editing mistake that I feel like today would have just been done differently. It's a kind of standard now for movies to start with a, you know, sort of exciting scene, and it just seems like this is so obviously the scene you start with, and the fact that they didn't do it this way is baffling to me. I mean, I get it. They're trying to set up the characters. And
yeah, but you can still do that.
Right. That's the next scene, you know? Then you get into your characters. Then we find out who they were. So, yeah, I don't really understand the storytelling decision there to place this later in the movie. And when it comes up in the movie, it's just kind of like random, like
yes.
as they're traveling.
Yeah, it's as they're traveling, it just cuts to like, oh, now we're going to see how they've been fending off the dragon.
And we've already sort of been teased as to what that's going to look like anyway. So yeah, I don't know. I don't get it. It's a weird flaw in the movie that really bugs me for some reason when I watch it now.
Yeah.
I'm like, just move this to the beginning of the movie.
Just cut this chunk and move it. It's just Tetris. Move it over.
Right. It's like, I want to edit the movie myself. Do a fan edit. Just move that scene. But I do like these characters that we're introduced to. Peter McNichol is a weird choice for a leading man, or would you say?
I don't know. I mean, it's definitely, it's not like he's this dashing, gallant guy. I mean, I think it fits for the character because he's so wanting to be a sorcerer, and it's so not what he's supposed to be doing. So I think he captures that well, as far as like being kind of awkward and kind of a tryhard.
Well, and they're clearly going for like a Luke Skywalker thing, you know, like, oh, here's our sort of farm boyish type of hero. He's, you know, not the obvious, you know, hunk or whatever.
Right.
But I mean, Luke Skywalker had a dashing quality about him or something.
Yes. No, and Peter McNichol, charming as he is, he's not, you know, it's not like, ew, or anything like that. I mean, I think he's fine and he does a good job. He's a good actor and he's charming, but it's not, he's no Luke Skywalker in that way.
This was apparently one of his first acting jobs.
Well, it was his first feature. He had started on Broadway, I believe, for Crimes of the Heart. That was in 1981 as well. It was his Broadway debut. And he actually received a Theater World Award for that. So he started off really hot out of the gate and then landed this feature film.
Later on, he would be in Ghostbusters 2. And most famously, he ended up in Ally McBeal.
And he was also in Sophie's Choice.
Those are pretty big things to be involved in. And of course, Ralph Richardson, who's playing the wizard, is a famous British actor. I believe he's a Sir Ralph Richardson. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he was sort of a big deal. But again, he's sort of in the vein of Alec Guinness playing Obi-Wan Kenobi or whatever, you know, get the British thespian in to do the old wizard who's going to die role. And that is what happens to the wizard here. He makes a big show of how, like, oh, he can make it on this journey. And the Galen character, as played by Peter McNichol, is like, you'll only make it a league or whatever. But the wizard's like, no, no, I'll be able to do it. And then he goes outside the castle and this villainous Tyrion is out there. And he's like, you know, don't wizards usually perform a test to prove that they can do the magic they say they can do? And then the wizard's like, okay, I'm fine to do a test. Go fetch my dagger, Galen. And so Galen gets his dagger and throws it down. And the wizard has this Tyrion guy stab him with the dagger as if this is going to prove that he can't be killed. But it just proves that he can be killed.
That's
and
right.
He dies.
Womp, womp.
I remember seeing this as a kid and thinking like, well, this is kind of a grim way to start the movie. Like, we haven't even gotten anywhere and already the wizard's dead.
I haven't even left the wizard castle or whatever this is, this area where they're living. They haven't even, I mean, he went outside the gates and got killed. That was it.
That's right. Obi-Wan Kenobi got to go to the Death Star and fight Darth Vader and everything, at least.
Not in this movie. The guy who played Tyrion is named John Hallam.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also in Flash Gordon.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, he's one of the Hawkmen, I believe.
Yep.
Or he's one of the tree guys.
I think it's a tree guy.
Okay.
And that was, you know, before this film. And then later on, a few years later, he's in Life Force.
Another film I like.
I know.
I can't remember who he is in that movie.
He's doing a lot of things. I guess he also did some Doctor Who.
Yes, you have to be in Doctor Who if you're a British actor. He's good. I like him in this movie. He's got a good villainous presence. You know right away, like, he's the cad. I do feel like this movie struggles a little bit to sort of fit him in. For the most part, I think the story of this movie is pretty solid. But, you know, they do have that problem of, there is, you know, the main threat, of course, is the dragon, but the dragon is an animal. And so, you know, it's sort of like Jaws, you know, the shark is the villain. And then you've got to, you know, populate your story with actual human personalities.
Well, like the mayor would be the king in this.
Right. Yes. Yeah, we were really noticing the similarities to Jaws.
A lot of Jaws going on here. Yeah, the king is definitely a problem because, as we learn with these maidens that are being sacrificed to keep the dragon at bay, there's this lottery. And we learn that not all maidens are getting entered into the lottery.
Yes. For instance, the king's daughter, Lisbeth, is not being entered into the lottery. And so we get this sort of story with her where she is upset about that because she's actually a honorable person. And so she wants to be put in the lottery and she ends up putting her own name in the lottery like 100 times. So that she is sent to be sacrificed to the dragon.
Yeah, she didn't know that they were doing this. And she was pretty horrified. And so her idea of putting her name in there so many times, I think, was also honoring all the times she hadn't been in there.
Yeah.
Her father, of course, was just freaked out. But Tyrion is his right-hand guy. So right. Tyrion is the muscle that's out there trying to regulate things, trying to make sure that, well, the character of Valerian that we, you know, you could obviously tell was a girl who's, you know, disguised as a boy.
Yes.
Which we do get that reveal pretty early on.
Yeah.
We're in a very sexy swimming scene.
Mm-hmm. A very sexy swimming hole scene.
They had kept her true gender a secret so she didn't have to go through this lottery. Her dad had had her dressing like a boy and acting like a boy, and she could carry her own. I mean, she was out there with this whole gang of guys,
yeah,
you know, going out on this adventure to try to get the wizard sorcerer. I say wizard sorcerer, same thing.
Same thing.
Yeah. To come and defeat the dragon.
Now, were you clued into the fact that Caitlin Clark was not a male character in the first few scenes?
I mean, she's a pretty woman. If she was, you know, I mean, it's kind of like seeing Julie Andrews play Peter Pan or something like that.
Right.
You know, where it's like, okay, well, I guess if she's supposed to be male, that's okay. But she really, I mean, I could tell she was female.
She's got a boyish look and they make her look boyish. And yeah, she does her best to sort of lower her voice and sound like a boy. I appreciate the effort. But even as a kid, when I first saw it, I was like, there's something off about this boy. Thankfully, though, they do reveal the truth of the character pretty early on
when they're on their trip. And Galen goes to dive in to the swimming hole when they're out there. And this Valerian is like, no, don't come in here. Leave me alone. And we see him dive underwater. And it's clearly a female figure.
Get a little bit of side boob.
That's right. PG side boob.
I think that's a body double side boob, though. I don't think that's Caitlin Clark's side boob, sadly. We should talk a little bit about the whole magical mechanism that's going to sort of drive this movie. After the sorcerer dies, Galen finds this sort of amulet, mm-hmm, that seems to have sort of this glowing power. And that's what gives him the impetus to think that he can actually step into the sorcerer's place and be the de facto sorcerer and go slay this dragon himself, which is, you know, an act of hubris because he doesn't really know what he's doing.
No, he knows just enough to be dangerous. Like, right, he knows enough, you know, spells or incantations or whatever. And then now he's got this amulet. So he's able to do some things, but it's not solid. He needed some more training with Ralph Richardson before he, you know, went out on his own to do this. And I mean, I understand he died, sure, but it's, yeah, he's not ready.
He can do stuff like levitate eggs.
Yeah.
He's, you know, trying to catch up with the group with this, like, poor old man that's sort of the sorcerer's helper. I forget the man's name. It's like Hob or something like that.
Hodge.
The poor old man is, you know, saying to him, like, you're no sorcerer. You can't cut it or whatever. But Galen is just blustering through and, you know, moving stuff around and doing things that are just like a little bit better than like magician parlor tricks, but more or less the equivalent, you know. And he shows up at the camp in a puff of smoke and, you know, all of these travelers are like, well, I don't know if you can really pull this off, but he insists that he can. And then after that swimming hole scene, poor Hodge gets shot with an arrow by Tyrion.
That's right.
And killed, which seemed just sort of cruel. Like, what was the reason? I forget the reason that Tyrion even did that.
Just
got to
get poor Hodge out of the way, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be fair, Hodge is pretty old and is, yeah, probably not going to be much of a help. But what that does is that gives Hodge this opportunity to give Galen the ashes of the sorcerer.
Right. Because when the sorcerer died, they cremated him. And we should note that the flames were unusual. It was like sorcery type green fire.
Yes. We should say that the director of this film is Matthew Robbins. Mm-hmm. He was mainly a writer who, you know, worked with a lot of famous people over the years. I believe he had something to do with the American New Wave, which is connected to the French New Wave. And speaking of which, Jean-Luc Godard died today. You know, I thought he died years ago, but, you know, we should note that he was a big factor in cinema and he is gone now. So RIP Jean-Luc Godard.
And he had a really good run.
Really good run. But anyway, yeah, so Matthew Robbins was mainly a writer. I think he does a good job here as a director.
He actually wrote Crimson Peak.
Oh, wow.
That wasn't that long ago.
No, so he's kind of still working.
Yes, and he did the, it says the, he's credited for the screen story for Mimic.
Oh, interesting.
And did a screenplay also for Batteries Not Included.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to make note of is that this was one of Ralph Richardson's last films.
Was it?
Yeah, he died in 1983. So
oh, wow.
I think he had Time Bandits maybe after this. It was the same
That's
year,
right.
I think.
Another film 1981. I really enjoy.
Yeah, it was right after this. And then, yeah, he did a couple other things up until he passed in 83.
I thought he lived longer than that. It's because he reminds me of John Gielgud. They kind of look similar. Mm-hmm. And John Gielgud lived longer. Well, RIP Ralph Richardson.
And poor Caitlin Clark didn't live that long. She passed at age 52.
Oh, really?
She had ovarian cancer.
Oh, that's terrible.
I know. And she actually wasn't British. She was from Pittsburgh.
You're just dropping the knowledge.
Thanks, IMDb.
Well, RIP Caitlin Clark. I'm
yeah,
sorry to
I know.
Hear that.
It's a bummer.
Oh, and I also wanted to bring up the score because the score actually was up for an Academy Award. It lost to Chariots of Fire, which if you were alive in 1981 and listened to the radio, you heard the theme to Chariots of Fire all the time. It was a big deal.
See, I think I actually had that on 45.
Uh-huh.
Big surprise.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing that on TV a lot. Like I just pictured them running on the beach.
Do, 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 do. So no surprise that it lost to that score.
Yeah.
But I believe the composer's name is Alex North. And it was funny because I wasn't really aware of him as a composer. And then I was watching Cleopatra today and he did the music for that.
And Spartacus, which you, what, didn't you watch that not too
I
long
did.
Ago?
Back to the movie.
Back to the movie.
Hodge gives Galen the satchel and he tells him like something like, look to the water, or he gives him some really vague directions about fire on the water or
right,
something like
right,
that.
Right, right, yes.
Which will come into play
it
later.
It does.
Then they take a boat and then they end up pretty much on the shoreline, around the shoreline of the Erland or wherever they're from. And they're passing by the cave where the dragon is.
Mm-hmm.
They're just intending to pass by and go to the village and get prepared and everything. But Galen's like, I want to look at where the cave is. And Valerian's like, don't go look at the cave now or whatever. He's like being all headstrong and he goes off and he goes in and he sort of like pokes around inside the cave. And the cave set is really cool. We will revisit this set mm-hmm. many times throughout the movie. It's a really nice cave. I'm into the cave. He hears the dragon moving around and some like smoke blows out of a tunnel. And it sort of spooks him. So he runs out. But then he uses the amulet to cause a cave-in over the entrance of the cave. And I just got to say, one, the entrance of the cave looked a lot like a vagina.
It sure did. Yes.
Okay, so it wasn't just
no,
me.
No, I saw it too. Vag cave.
I also want to note that the dragon must really have to squeeze himself to
right?
get out of that cave.
That dragon is huge.
Yeah, it's
huge. It's like birthing the dragon each time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those were definitely two things to note. Yeah, it's a very small entrance to the cave for this giant dragon.
And Galen uses the amulet to cause a cave-in, and it goes a little bit bigger than I think he intended, because at first just a few rocks fall down, and then we get this like massive avalanche.
Kind of like an earthquake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, it's like having just enough knowledge and power to be dangerous.
Right.
And a couple of things I wanted to note here is one, this whole area where the dragon lives is really cool. And I think this also, when they're leading up to that along the water with all the rocks and everything, that again reminds me very much of Game of Thrones, yeah. like Casterly Rock or something, one of those places in the kingdom.
I didn't research it or anything, but I'm pretty sure a lot of these locations are close to locations that they've used for Game of Thrones and like areas where they've shot.
I think
stuff.
They shot it. Was I reading that was it Scotland?
I cannot confirm nor deny.
Yeah, it was Scotland and Wales. Primarily.
I know they filmed a lot of Game of Thrones in Wales.
Yes. So. Yeah, it looks very much like that. So yeah, I was really into that. And then of course, Galen, yes, causes this mini avalanche. And boy, is he proud of himself. He is puffed up. It's like, well, I guess this is the shortest fantasy movie there ever was.
Yeah.
We're done here. Everything's fine. The dragon's just going to starve to death in the cave, I guess.
They go to the village and they're just throwing a party.
Yep.
They're already burning effigies of the dragon. Valerian decides to come out in a nice dress, revealing her gender to the world. She's having a gender reveal party.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, I mean, everything must be fine, right?
Yeah.
There must be no problem at all. And yeah, so Galen has to like go before the king, and this is where we meet the king and the princess and everything. And the king ain't so sure about all this. He's not really buying that the dragon has really been put down, which turns out to be right, because then the dragon comes up out of the ground and attacks the town.
And boy, the dragon is pissed.
Now, in my mind, I remembered this scene being more of a long scene of like the dragon attacking
more
the town.
Destruction.
It reminds me a lot of the dragon attacking Lake Town in The Hobbit. They went really big with that sort of same idea. I do think the dragon in The Hobbit is pretty good. It's the Smaug dragon as played by Benedict Cumberbatch, since we're talking dragons, but
I'll just take your word for it.
One day you'll end up watching it when I'm watching it. Anyway, so the dragon attacks and burns up the town, so they've got to throw themselves another lottery. And now, you know, our heroine Valerian has got to throw her name in the pot.
And they're trying to, Tyrion is coming like hunting for Galen at this point.
Yeah.
Was this when he got locked up?
Yes.
Was this, okay, so he's locked up and this is when he tells the princess, Elsbeth, you know, there's a lottery and you haven't been in it.
Yeah.
He's the one that reveals that.
Yeah, and the king takes his amulet from
him
at this point.
That's
so
right.
It's no longer in his possession. So he's essentially been depowered.
Mm-hmm.
We also are learning that there's basically this growing faction of Christianity.
Yes. It's unfortunate because when we get to the end of the film, it's definitely looked upon like it was some sort of miracle.
Well, I mean, I think the movie's trying to make a kind of statement about Christianity, which is pretty crazy if you think about it, in a Disney movie.
In 1981.
Right. This movie was essentially marketed like a Disney film, like even though it's a co-production with Paramount. I remember Disney being said a lot in the promotion or whatever. They were like, the definitive dragon movie from Disney. And you have to remember also that around this time is that era of Disney that we like.
But is it, but no one else liked.
Exactly.
Like I was just thinking, I was like, this is Watcher in the Woods. This is, we're coming up on something wicked.
Yep.
Yeah, this is the Disney that we, dark Disney, but not everyone else was here for dark Disney.
No, and this movie is dark.
Yeah.
For a movie that is essentially aimed at children, it's pretty complex in its themes, and it's pretty dark in its presentation.
Absolutely. There's no lightheartedness here. There will be no fun in Dragon Slayer.
There's some lightheartedness. That's not entirely true. But it's the way it's presented is so sort of gritty. It's gritty.
Yeah, but it's not. I don't remember there being. Are there laughs?
I think they intended some things to be funny.
Right, but not as much as like a true, like what we know Disney to be now would be.
Oh, yeah. Nowhere even near what Disney or Marvel would do.
There'd be probably a song in here or something too.
Oh, yeah. There's no songs to be had other than the like medieval music they play at the celebration. It's gritty. And I mean, it feels like Game of Thrones light in a lot of ways.
It's Game of Thrones Junior. It's definitely gritty is an excellent way to describe it. I mean, it's just how the look of it is.
Right.
I mean, even just how it's shot and just like the way that it actually looks feels gritty.
Yeah, and I really love the way a lot of the sword and sorcery movies looked at this time with that sort of grittiness, that sort of used, everybody's a little dirty.
Yeah.
Then, you know, they use fog a lot. Mm-hmm. Things are misty and yes. foggy.
Yes.
And even like the camera has a little bit of kind of almost smeared, blurry look to it. It's just a look that I really enjoy. And it was very much kind of the style of fantasy movies of that era.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what got me into fantasy movies, honestly, like these movies.
Oh, I have to believe that if you had been fed a diet of Disney today fantasy movies, that you would have not had the love that you have for fantasy movies. You're too dark.
Yeah, I always went in directions that were darker, and I always responded to things that were grittier and felt more realistic. So if I was a young person, I don't know, in the 90s, I probably wouldn't have enjoyed fantasy. But it's kind of come back around with all the gritty TV shows.
That's right.
Anyway, so they have to have another sacrifice, and we get this scene where they're back at the cave, and this religious leader, who is played by Ian McDiarmid, who is going to go on to play the Emperor in Return of the
That's
Jedi,
right.
You know, he's doing this speech where he's trying to basically banish the dragon as if it was the devil or something.
I think he calls it Lucifer or something
right.
like that.
And, you know, we're seeing, like, the dragon, I guess, coming up through like the cracks of the earth. It's kind of like there's this earthquake going on and there's this big crack forms right at his feet, basically. And he's got this kind of cool staff mm-hmm. with like a cross in it. I like those staffs.
Yeah.
If I was a religious nut job, I'd bring those staffs back. But anyway, here we're treated to a little bit more of the dragon. The dragon sort of rises up from the ground at Ian McDiarmid. We don't quite see it yet, but it's pretty cool because it's like a big giant dragon head. And like the maiden who sacrificed earlier in the movie, he just gets immolated by fire. And again, it's pretty graphic for a Disney movie. I mean, you see him get lit on fire.
You see him get lit on fire to the point that there's a shot of him where he's bald to insinuate that like the hair just got all burned off.
Yep.
Like there's a flash of that happens and his like face is like, wah! Because you can't see me doing that. My eyes are bugged out and, hey, you know, looks like he's been struck by lightning or something.
It recalls a little bit Raiders of the Lost Ark, mm-hmm. which came out this same year, the end of that
movie. With the melting faces.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's totally got that. But that's what Disney was doing.
And it's why they were failing. We'll be revisiting this topic later on. So that didn't work. The dragon's still around. They've got to do a little bit more than just try to pray it away. So Galen is released from the prison by the king because mm-hmm. the king is like, I want you to save my daughter because yep. she's now going to be the next sacrifice.
That's
because
right.
as we said, she put her name in the lottery. And when she did that, Galen actually like was able to sneak in.
He didn't even have to sneak in. He went in to sneak in to get the amulet
right.
and the king was like, gave it to him.
Right. I'm misremembering things. The princess frees Galen earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're having the lottery where her name is drawn from the pot, that's when he sneaks in to steal the amulet and the king catches him and is like, here, just take it and save
yeah.
my daughter.
Yeah.
It's very well constructed in that way. Like I appreciated the way that the film was written, other than, you know, my gripe about the scene that should have been in the beginning.
Yeah, but that's editing.
That could have been editing. It may have been written differently.
Right.
I actually feel like the structure of this movie is pretty solid.
I agree. And I actually would say I believe all the motivations and I appreciate the relationships. And I believe that the king is, you know, truly desperate because now his daughter is literally going to be the sacrifice.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just the stakes are high and he's a, you know, when it comes out to it, he's her dad.
Yeah. The way that all the characters are positioned is well thought out. No one is motivated, as you said, in any sort of weird way. Like it all kind of makes sense.
And it's kind of, now that I'm just talking it out with you, like it's a lot about, you know, the maidens are younger girls and their dads, because
right.
also Valerian just has her dad.
Right. Who's a blacksmith.
Yeah.
And that's a good point to bring up now because, you know, as Galen is now preparing to go in and try to fight the dragon proper, he's got to have some kind of weapon. And any sort of quest or fantasy story, the character has to at some point find their weapon in which mm-hmm. they're going to use to vanquish the enemy. What I like about this movie is, you know, usually it's a sword. It's almost always a sword. Right. But in this movie, it's not. It's a spear.
That's right.
Which, you know, if you think about it, would probably be more effective against a dragon.
Hell yeah, this dragon is huge. You have much more of a chance to chuck a spear at him.
Yeah. And this spear is pretty cool.
Yeah. Like,
it's a long spear with a really badass pointy tip. Valerian's father forged it. And then I guess he had to like hide it away for whatever reason. I believe this is actually explained in the novelization of Dragon Slayer, which you bet your bottom that if I ever find that novelization, I am buying it.
Oh boy. Now I have to go find the novelization of Dragon Slayer.
Don't try to find it online or something. It's got to be something I find.
You need to find it at a bookstore.
But yeah, so Valerian's father has forged the spear and we get the scene where like, they're like heating it up with the amulet and stuff.
It's totally like a suit up scene. And it's just totally reminds me of Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, they drew from this. I mean, it's just such a trope for this and not a bad one. But this is like, you know, you're getting the blacksmith and the pieces are coming together. And I also appreciate that Valerian's dad, I mean, he had it ready to go.
Yeah.
He was like, oh, well, this is what you need. I mean, yeah, they have to do some magical things to it.
Well, he like hit it in a river.
Yeah.
It was like in a river on a chain.
Right.
He pulls it out of the river.
But he had already like made this.
I think that what we're supposed to think is that he made this weapon, but then, you know, he wasn't allowed to use it because, you know, they decided we're not going to try to kill the dragon. We're
yeah.
going to sacrifice one of our daughters every solstice or something, I believe they say. So, you know, he just wasn't allowed to actually use it. And he probably would have died if he did.
Right.
Because, you know, as we're going to see, when you go after the dragon with a spear, it doesn't necessarily pan out.
You need a little more than the spear.
Yeah.
Even this like badass spear that they like make even more souped up.
Another item that Galen gets is Valerian goes off to the cave. And I like the way the scene is set up because she sort of leaves and Galen and the father are like, where did she go or whatever? And the father's like, oh, you know, she's not good at goodbyes or whatever. Yeah. I forget what he says exactly. But then we see her kind of hanging out by the dragon cave and you're like, what the hell are you doing, Valerian? Why are you fucking around near the dragon cave? But she's gathering scales
mm-hmm.
that have fallen off the dragon.
Yep.
And we've seen these before in the movie. That's what she originally presented to the wizard to prove that there was a dragon.
Right.
And she had a claw or whatever with her too. So she's gathered these scales and then Galen is sort of approaching the cave in that cool setting that you liked. That's all sort of shale rocks and stuff. It's really
Houses
visually,
of the Holy.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Houses of the Holy. I bet you anything that's where that album cover is shot. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, she shows up and she, you know, throws this shield that she's made down to Galen. And it's like, here, take this. And, you know, they have this scene where, you know, she's like, I'll never see you again because you're going to die. And I can tell that you're in love with the princess and everything.
Oh, no, she's saying, I can tell that you're in love. And he's like, yeah, I am in love or whatever. And she totally thinks it's with the princess, Elsbeth.
Yeah.
And no, dummy. He's in love with you, Valerian.
Right. You made a sarcastic comment while we were watching that these two were really steaming up the screen. Did you feel that this romance was at least likable?
Oh, yeah. No, I thought they were super sweet. I just was joking because it's like they're both, you know, fine looking people or whatever, but it's not Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford
no.
or, you know, it's just if we're going to talk about, you know, films from around that time that, you know, we're making comparisons to other romances of similar fantasy films. I mean, even though Star Wars is different than this type of fantasy, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm just saying it's not like it's not a super hot romance. It's a sweet romance.
It's no Flash Gordon and Dale Arden.
Oh no.
In the 1980 Flash Gordon.
Steamy. Sebastian watched House of the Dragon in real time mm-hmm. on Sunday, but I was not able to. So I had to just catch up tonight. And
it had a beautiful romance in it, didn't you think?
So much about family, family bonds. No, but just like the steamiest of steam episodes. And so it's just, yes. So this romance that we're talking about tonight with Dragon Slayer was very sweet.
Well, and it's also hilarious because the whole threat that's going on here, obviously, is the dragon. But the thing is that only maidens who are virgins can be sent to the dragon.
Well, that's what a maiden is.
Right.
She's virtuous.
No, they literally say virgins.
Yeah.
It has to be virgins.
Right.
Just have sex.
I know. But like, as we know from just watching House of the Dragon, that's like the worst thing you can do.
Don't you think, though, that in this village, all the women would be like, I am having sex.
Hell yes. Sure, I'll be the town trollop, but I'm not going to be charred up by the dragon. I do have some questions, and I'm not debating the writing here or sure. anything, but the dragon's not even eating these people.
I know.
Like, it just comes out and he gets to just, or she, I don't know, because we find out there's little dragons, so it might be a female dragon.
That's right.
I'm going to say she because I want to. She like just gets to like annihilate these maidens. It's not even a food source.
I 100% agree with you that the logic behind sacrificing maidens to this dragon doesn't really make a lot of sense. And I think that's why the religious stuff is brought in.
Right.
You know what I mean? I think that's kind of the justification for that. Even though the religion is almost kind of like separate from all of this in a way, I think that what we're supposed to believe is that this is just what they think is going to work. And for whatever reason, you know, when the dragon comes out and does this, it doesn't go and destroy the village for whatever reason.
Right.
Like, this is enough for it to not it.
Yeah, to keep her cool or whatever.
Right.
But especially Christianity of that time loves a sacrifice.
Exactly. You know, and it's supposed to be the dawn of Christianity.
Yeah.
Like, I was reading on Wikipedia that they deliberately sort of conceived this to be taking place right at that moment that Christianity was starting mm-hmm. to take hold in England. That's sort of what they're getting at. And I think that's the movie's attempt at sort of trying to explain why these villagers think that that's going to work.
Okay.
You know, because obviously, you know, we don't know what the dragon's thinking.
No. And I mean, they're just trying whatever to like make it stop and make it not attack their village. So, I mean, it's as illogical as it seems. Hell, if I was there at the time, I'd be like, this is working. Just keep throwing the maidens in there.
And not to show my hand as to how I feel about religions, but, you know, religion loves to just bash its head against the wall of logic and do things that makes no sense and insist that it works, you know, like thoughts and prayers, that's going to stop it. So I think that's the idea, is that they're trying to thoughts and prayer the dragon away.
With a little bit of virgin sacrifice.
Sure. Well, that's the Middle Ages version of thoughts and prayers.
A little dash of virgin sacrifice.
Galen is presented with his shield and he goes to the mouth of the cave to kill the dragon, right? He's going to go inside the cave and he's going to kill the dragon. Elspeth is there. She's chained to this pillar where the dragon's going to come out mm-hmm. and kill her.
With the shackles.
And what happens here is Tyrion shows up
mm-hmm.
and he is trying to stop Galen essentially from going in and trying to kill the dragon. And this is a little bit clumsy because I feel like this is where they're just like, okay, we've set up this human villain in Tyrion. So we just have to like kind of get him out of the way. And there has to be some sort of scene between the hero and the human villain where they fight. And so, you know, it's Tyrion's sword against Galen's spear, and they're even trying to kind of do a little bit of lightsaber action, because every time their blades connect, you get the spark or whatever, because I guess, like, we're supposed to assume that the spear has been imbued with some sort of magic because of the amulet.
Yes.
And they're basically fighting around this pillar, and at one point, Galen hits the chain that Elspeth is chained with and is like, run. You know, he's trying to save her life, but she doesn't run away. She runs into the cave.
And this is where I was getting really frustrated with Elspeth, because I was like, she is the martyrdom of all time. Like, she just really has this guilt for not being in the lottery.
Sure, yeah.
And, or maybe she really hates her life and hates being a princess, or who knows, but she is not running away. She's running right into trouble.
And the trouble that she runs into will not be the dragon itself, but the dragon's babies, mm-hmm. which are these basically hand puppets, but they're fun. They look cool.
They reminded me, as I said when we were watching it, of Ghoulies a little bit.
They totally are like Ghoulies. Mm-hmm. But like, what happens to her is grisly.
Oh my God. They're just eating, or it's like she's laid out as like a feast and they're just like tearing off her feet and just chowing down.
Yeah. When Galen comes in to try to find her, he finds her like laid out on this rocky altar of sorts and these baby dragons just chowing down on her. And it's pretty gory for a PG Disney movie.
Again, Disney. Going hard.
We should say that Galen wins the fight with Tyrion by stabbing through the pillar and stabbing him.
He goes through, the pillar. This is a cool shot because he like goes through, it shows that it goes through the wood.
Yes.
And that's how he gets him. So goodbye, Tyrion.
Now, this whole segment with Galen going into the cave and sort of facing off against the dragon is kind of the big show-stopping scene in which they're really bringing out all the stops with all the different ways they're presenting the dragon. And in my mind, this is where the movie ends.
Yes. Well, and this is a problem I have. There's too many endings.
Yeah, I do agree with you, but I kind of also appreciate that it's not the end.
I can see that too. It would have been too easy if that was the end, but I also just don't like having to go back to the same thing again. You know, it doesn't work.
Right.
He comes in and he's making some headway, but the spear breaks off.
In the dragon.
In the dragon.
Yes.
So he has to retreat.
And we should say this whole sort of scene, you know, he goes into the cave and in the cave is this big pool of fire water, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, remember what Hodge said to him about the fire on the water. But, you know, at this point, he doesn't figure that out, what that means. The dragon just comes out of the fire water and, you know, we get all these different shots. We fully see the dragon at this point.
Which is great.
It's impressive. And it's blasting fire at him and his, you know, dragon scale shield is actually
working, keeping
him alive.
Yes.
But, you know, he's pretty outclassed by this dragon the whole time. He's basically just in retreat and doing what he can to try to jab the spear in the dragon, but he doesn't succeed other than breaking the spear off in the dragon, which does not kill it. And yeah, so in my mind, I'm like, oh, he goes into the cave and he kills the dragon.
Nope.
But that isn't what happens.
Mm-mm.
The dragon does not die. He gets his ass kicked, basically, and has to go back to the village with his tail between his legs, so to speak.
And this is when he's kind of does that thing that happens to heroes often where he kind of gives up, right? Is like he and Valerian are just going to run away together.
I mean, it's what we call in screenwriting the lowest moment,
mm-hmm.
like where the hero is brought to the very lowest point that they can be brought to. It is a little weird that in this movie, they basically give up.
Yeah, like totally give up.
And they're like, well, we'll just run away.
We'll just leave.
And at some point, like Galen like looks in the water and he sees fire and then he pieces it together that's what Hodge meant about the fire.
And we should mention he's been doing this throughout the film. He gets visions in water. It happened, I think, also back at the beginning when they first like headed off on the quest, like he saw some sort of a premonition or something in the water.
Right.
It's not the first time it's happened.
This is all happening pretty quick.
Yeah.
Like this all happens within like a span of like 5 minutes. Like,
yeah.
He goes back to the village. They're like, okay, we've got to leave. Then he sees the vision.
Yes.
And then it's back to the cave.
And that's where I'm just like, ugh.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's something that I always notice in movies when you return to a location one too many times.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, we're back here. It makes the movie feel repetitive and small.
Definitely small. And we've been to the cave like probably like 5 times now.
I agree with you that it makes it feel like we're just kind of going in circles.
It's
a little
Groundhog's
bit
Day.
Narratively.
But I also agree with you that I'm glad that he didn't just finish the job in one swoop. But I just wish it could have been at a different location, maybe.
I'm kind of with you there.
Wow.
And what he does is he pours the ashes of the sorcerer on the water. And
this is back in the cave.
In the cave where the dragon is. And I guess the dragon's off flying around or something at this point. I don't quite remember exactly why the dragon's not in the cave.
But the dragon did discover the babies were all dead.
Right. So the dragon's pissed.
Yes.
And is going probably after the village for vengeance. Yes. Or something like that. So he pours the ashes in the water and Ralph Richardson comes back in the green fire.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, thank you, my boy, or whatever. And I'll go take care of this.
And I do appreciate that Ralph Richardson's like, do you have anything to eat?
Right.
Because it's like, he's been dead for a while and he's like, he's back alive now. He's hungry.
I often think about that. If like, hey, if there is a spirit realm, like, do you get to eat food there? Because I would think I would miss delicious food.
I mean, I know when I just take a long nap, I wake up hungry. That's so right.
Yeah, I like that line too. Mm-hmm. See, there is jokes.
No, that there movie. There's some lighthearted stuff there. Yes.
So yeah, they have to now enact this plan to kill the dragon, and we get this sort of final sequence, which is going to mostly feature the dragon flying around.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's Galen Valerian and Ralph Richardson. Mm-hmm. And Ralph Richardson is like, okay, at the right time, you need to destroy the amulet.
And he's like, you'll know when it's the right time. You'll know. And right. He's got like this rock ready to smash the amulet. And Valerian keeps wanting him to smash it.
Before the time That's is right. right. And, you know, it's pretty clear what's going to happen. Ralph Richardson is going to call the dragon to him, and then the dragon's going to grab him, and then you've got to smash the amulet, and then Ralph Richardson's going to blow up and kill the dragon, right?
Like Jaws.
It's very much like Jaws. The shark has got to get the tank in its mouth, and then Roy Scheider's got to shoot the tank at the right time and blow up the shark.
Or the cable at Cable Junction, if you like Jaws 2.
Or the cable at Cable Junction, yes.
Bite down on it, you son of a bitch!
It is too bad that there wasn't a line of sorts in this movie. I mean, it doesn't really fit.
No, it's not the right
medieval setting, but I don't know. They could have thought of something. But, you know, we're getting a lot of fun special effects here of the dragon flying around. And when Ralph Richardson's up on the mountain, he's like calling the lightning and calling a storm and everything. It gets a little Disney trippy for a minute there. Reminds me a little bit of Witch Mountain or whatever from Fantasia.
Yep.
And I mean, that's basically the way the climax plays out. Gotta smash the amulet. When are you gonna smash the amulet? We gotta wait till the right time. And Valerian wants to do it right away. Galen's holding her back, and Ralph Richardson's, you know, yelling at the dragon, and the dragon's flying around. And it's just a way to show off special effects, and it's basically the Jaws ending.
And they should be showing off special effects because they were pretty incredible, especially for this time. Like, that's like, it's really cool.
It's what we're here for. Right.
That's exactly what we're here for. And the next thing that I'm here for is the aftermath.
The aftermath is pretty impressive.
Again, holy fucking Disney.
Right.
Like, are you kidding me? There's so much dragon guts and meat and blood and just pieces like the shark exploding in Jaws. Like, but we linger over because the dragon's so huge. Right. Yeah. And so we've got like Galen and Valer. I mean, everyone's like, you really get the enormous size, how humbling it is to be these humans with this dragon, like how big this creature they've been fighting is in just the meaty, pulpiest horror film pieces.
Yeah, you see like the rib cage of the dragon, its tongue's like hanging out of its mouth. I mean, I'd be cutting off pieces of that dragon to eat. I mean, that's probably good eating. It probably tastes like alligator.
Oh, Sevi.
Look, it's already dead, okay?
I guess.
I mean, you might as well feed your family with that thing.
Sure. Want not, waste not. Exactly. Yes. But it's pretty gross.
It is pretty gross, especially for a Disney movie.
Yeah.
You really want to see the dragon that fucked up and dead? I don't know.
I didn't know I wanted to, but then I saw it and I was like, whoa.
But what's kind of clever here is that we're seeing all the different sort of factions come out and like claim victory here.
Yeah, this is when we get, so again, calling back to a recent episode of House of the Dragon, where it's like all the work is done and then, you know, oh, here comes the king. He's the one that slayed the beast, yeah. You know, and it's just like, it's so like if they had cameras, it would be a photo op.
Totally.
And then, yeah, and then here comes the Christian clan.
And now is being led by one of the characters that was in the original group that went to see the wizard. And it's a character that didn't figure in too much, but he's become sort of religious over the course of the story. And now he's the religious leader.
These folks are also like claiming that they prayed it away or whatever, yeah. You know, so it's everyone. And it's just kind of an eye roll. And I don't even think I think Galen's kind of like, whatever, yeah. You know, like, let's just go off together. And, you know, he doesn't, his arc is he's grown and he doesn't need the glory from this. He doesn't care. He knows what happened. He was there. Valerian was there. He got to have his friend Ralph Richardson, the wizard, back to, you know, take care of this. And this is, you know, Ralph Richardson was like, this is how it was always supposed to be. Well, Galen figures that out. He's like, you knew you couldn't make the trip. Like, yeah. This is, you know, what you wanted to happen. Because he couldn't have physically made it all the way there.
Yeah.
So this was the only way that he could do his part, was to die and come back.
Well, and what I like about it is at the end of the movie, Galen's like, I just was never cut out to be a sorcerer.
Right.
Which is such an unusual kind of character arc.
No, I love that.
For the hero to realize like, I was never cut out for that.
I think that's maybe the thing I like most about this film, is because he was trying to make a circle fit into a square. And he's like, he's realized that by going through this, and he did what he needed to do. He was able to like pull it off, but he's like, I'm not supposed to be this. I just want to go be with you, Valerian. Like, let's just go live our lives.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people take some many more dragon slayings to figure out that maybe you're doing something you shouldn't be doing.
There is a little hint, though, that maybe he's got some kind of magic in him, because they're walking to their new life or whatever, and they're like, I sure do wish we had a horse.
Oh, right.
And then a horse kind of magically appears, and they get on the horse and laugh as they ride off.
I like to think that that was just good karma for him, like, handling the stuff that he needed to do and being the hero he needed to be. And now he can just go live his life with Valerian. And that's it. The end.
So, Jennifer, why do you think this failed?
I think it probably failed because it needed maybe some, I mean, and I, again, I like the cast. I like I think the acting is all great, but I think maybe it needed more well-known leads, or at least one more well-known lead. I mean, I know some of these are British actors, but if it was going to succeed in the States, it like needed somebody like a little more cachet, whether it be Galen or Valerian or somebody, I don't know, to kind of bring people into the theater, I guess. I honestly do not recall how the trailers were for this or how it was advertised. I can tell you that in all the films of this time, this one, I can remember the name, but I didn't really remember what it was about. Whereas, you know, I'm definitely more familiar with Beastmaster and Conan and even Lady Hawk, that I keep forgetting the name. But even though the you know, you were saying it was touting the special effects and like that's what, you know, but is that going to get everybody to go to the theater to see it? Like, I mean, I feel like if you would have had, you know, like a Michelle Pfeiffer or somebody, you know, playing the female lead, or, you know, somebody just a little more well known. I mean, this was Peter McNichol's film debut.
Yeah.
So I think that's asking a lot to be able to fill seats.
I think you bring up a really good point there, you know, and even if you look at something like Conan the Barbarian, even though Arnold Schwarzenegger wasn't really a big star, that movie was really sold on like his presence
and his physique.
His physique. And even they tried kind of the same trick with Beastmaster, because they, you know, Mark Singer was also kind of like a big guy or whatever.
And then you had Tanya Roberts, and at least she had some Charlie's Angels cachet.
Well, and Beastmaster was way, way less expensive than this movie.
Right.
The problem was this movie was super expensive.
Because the kick-ass effects.
Right. So they could have gotten away with not having big names in it if it had been cheaper, but, you know, they were trying to market and sell it on the special effects. And, you know, around that time, special effects were a big deal. Star Wars had made special effects a big deal. That's why Star Wars was the phenomenon that it was. I mean, there were a lot of other factors, and I think that they had a better cast in Star Wars. You had Harrison Ford, who was not a star yet, but it made him a star. Right. And Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill, and it had people that were destined to become
big deals.
Big deals. Whereas the actors in this, they're good, but they're just not that kind of
level
stars.
Yeah.
You know, they're not like people that you're going to want to go see their next movie or whatever.
You're not going to go to the movie just to see them. They're all good actors. They're technically good. It's a enjoyable experience to watch them on screen, but they're not going to make you see whatever they're doing next.
And I also think that it was yet again too dark for Disney. If this is being aimed at children, it's too dark. You know, there's half your audience right there, because you're like, we're making a dragon movie. Bring your kids. Oh, no, don't bring your kids. It's way too scary and
it's like
grisly.
Pete's Dragon.
Yeah, it's no, Pete's Dragon.
It's no Pete's Dragon, and it's Kinder Trauma Central. Like, this is nightmares. Like, you got the Christian guy, like, lit up. Like, you know, just the girls in the shackles with the bloody arms, like, trying to get out and getting killed. And, I mean, dragon guts. There's all kinds of things that is, like, could be total, like, kid nightmare fuel.
Well, I mean, I think we cracked the dragon's egg there and figured out why this failed. It's just a combination of being too big budget for what it is, being too dark for Disney, and not having enough star power is really what it comes down to.
Yeah.
I think that unfortunately slayed the dragon.
Oof. But that being said, I really enjoyed rewatching it. I mean, it had been decades since I'd seen it, and I like Dragon Slayer.
I, of course, am a big fan. And
you?
Well, but you know, it's not one of those movies that I watch all the time. And I don't own the Blu-ray or anything like that. I bought it for $5 on iTunes. So, you know, it's not a movie that I'm constantly revisiting. And like I said, you know, I loved it in the theater. And then when I would see it on TV, I would be like, you know, I like watching the dragon parts, but I wouldn't want to watch the whole movie.
And especially seeing it on a TV back then, like you said, it was so much smaller visually and audio.
Right.
Like it was, whereas now we're able to kind of make our own kind of home theater.
Yeah, definitely did not work great on pan and scan, you know, VHS or watching it on cable or whatever. It just didn't have the same effect. It was nice to revisit it this time because I was actually really able to appreciate how well written I think it is. And, you know, just seeing how kind of connected to Game of Thrones it is. And I don't know, I had a really enjoyable time watching it with you.
Oh.
And I do like Dragon Slayer. I don't know how often I would revisit it. And, you know, just because it's, you know, a little slow at times and, you know, it's not necessarily super dynamic in many ways, but it's definitely well constructed. And I appreciated not only the special effects, but the care in which the story is told.
It's good storytelling. Sorry to keep bringing up Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon, but it's just relevant. And I feel like because of those shows and having watched Game of Thrones a couple times, I think we watched it at least 2 times, right?
Yes.
And then, you know, watching House of the Dragon now and just more fantasy in my life because of you.
The weariness with which you say that is disheartening. No.
That was excitement. It was an adoration. But yeah, I appreciated it more and just took more of it in, I think, because I probably just missed it on TV too. Maybe because they're just it's something that deserves a big screen viewing. And unfortunately, not enough people went to see it on the big screen.
It has gained something of a cult following over the
years.
Has
it? I don't know anyone that's like, Dragon Slayer is my favorite.
I don't know if there's people that are that enthusiastic about it, but it definitely is well regarded by people who like sword and sorcery
fantasy
movies,
type things. Okay.
Fantasy movies. I mean, it's always been sort of well regarded in that niche audience. Like, it's always been well thought of as a good sword and sorcery fantasy movie. So yeah, I mean, and I think that over the years, and like all movies that gain a cult following, people have come to it. And I think, you know, in a post Game of Thrones world, probably more people would enjoy it if they gave it a shot.
If you're hungry for more sword and sorcery and fantasy, check out Dragon Slayer.
All right, well, I'm going to go get my magic amulet, stab an old man, and then sacrifice a virgin to a dragon.
You do you, Sebi.
That about does it today for Tentpole Trauma. If you like what you heard, check out our social media presence on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for Tentpole Trauma. That was easy, wasn't it? If you like us, hit subscribe and leave us a sterling review on iTunes, if you dare. If you really like us, head over to patreon.com and get involved in one of our fabulous tiers. You'll be glad you did. Want to communicate with Tentpole Trauma? Send an email to tentpoletrauma@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And who knows, one day you may even get your email read on one of our shows. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you real soon.